Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 280. How often have you heard about the speed of Python? What are they measuring? Where are the bottlenecks? Development time or runtime? And which will matter the most for your productivity? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week, bringing another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher shares an article titled, "The Uselessness of Fast and Slow in Programming." It digs into how the different aspects of software running span a broad range of orders of magnitude, how developers obsess over irrelevant performance details and risk losing more time programming in a suboptimal environment than building what they need with the tools they know. We discuss an article about why UV is fast. It details how most of UV's speed comes from engineering decisions and not from just being written in Rust. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, a roundup of 2025 year-end lists, why Python's deep copy can be so slow, serving a website with fast API using Jinja 2, Python numbers every programmer should know, a discussion about spec-driven development, and if Waterfall is back, a tool to detect whether a PDF has a bad redaction, and a CLI to measure HTTP request phases. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher. Welcome back.
Hey there. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. All right. Well, we have a couple of items that aren't quite news. They're sort of, I don't know, top list roundups from 2025. We had our own that people probably checked out a couple weeks ago. We thought we'd mention these because I think we actually mentioned them last year when this happened too, that there's a lot of this sort of reviewing going around. We got our typical topics and some projects, and we're going to dive into a discussion, which we haven't done that in a little bit. I'm going to pick your brain in an area that you are more familiar with in computer science and development.
And I will make the internet angry. So there you go.
All right. Sound off in the comments. All right. So let's start.
Yeah, sure. As you kind of hinted at there, the holidays are a little slow for news. Everyone's busy eating turkey and drinking champagne. And of course, depending on the amount of champagne, that's probably a good thing for the quality of code that you're not releasing things. So yeah. We're going to get a little meta here, a summary of summary articles. The tail end of 2025 saw lots of best of and how my 2025 went and whoa, 2025 sounds all futuristic kind of articles. So we thought we'd highlight a couple.
Yeah.
First off is the 11th annual Top Python Libraries Roundup from Tyro Labs, who we've featured in the past. This post has two top 10 lists, one for general Python libraries, and the other is specific to machine learning and data science type topics.
We dug pretty deep into this last year, and there's a lot of good stuff here. If you are, again, kind of doing your, like diving into the new year and wondering, well, what's going on as far as libraries and what they're being used for, I think it's a great first stop on your journey is to check out what's going on and what's being used. It also gives you an idea of other libraries that are popular. If you're a learner, these might be kind of cool things to check out. Obviously, things that were at the top were like things like Ty, which everybody was talking about, this blazing fast type checker from Astral, which Astral will come up again in this conversation. I always thought it was interesting because there's areas that you probably don't focus on. You might be wondering like, oh, what's going on in the AI ML area? Or maybe you haven't been following what's going on with general use. A lot of fast API, that will come up also later in the show. But I always like this rundown. I think it's a good gauge for people to end their year with or start their year with.
The second summary we wanted to highlight is actually a podcast episode. Talk Python did a big panel with six guests, and they discussed what mattered in Python for 2025. So a raucous bunch with strong opinions. So entertaining little listen there. And the third one is from the folks at PyPI. There was a blog post on everything they accomplished last year. There are some pretty impressive stats in here, including 130,000 new projects, 2.5 trillion requests served, and almost 2 exabytes of data. In case you're not up on the lingo, that's 1,000 petabytes. Or as Wikipedia puts it, enough data that it would take about 1 million home computers to store it all. So that's a lot of stuff shifted.
Yeah, and that's a modern home computer, I would guess.
Yes.
Not your Commodore 64s. One note on that, the PSF had a year-end fundraiser, and they met their goal. In fact, they broke their goal a couple times. They finished their fundraiser with over $500,000, which was pretty amazing. So thanks everybody who contributed and were part of it. And I'll include a link that also talks about not only the things that the PSF does in their year-end article here, but they're the ones that fund PyPI also. So another article that kind of ties the two together there. All right. Well, I guess that gets us into topics. So bringing back my astral comment here, my first article I want to touch on today is by Andrew Nesbitt. It's on his blog, nesbitt.io, and it's titled How UV Got So Fast. You've probably heard of UV, and you've probably heard us discuss it. In fact, Charlie Marsh was on the show last February. Charlie Marsh is the sort of head of Astral, and UV was the second of multiple tools that came out over the last couple of years, the first being Ruff, which was their linter and sort of rules checking tool. UV is a package manager, and it literally is an order of magnitude faster than pip, which is kind of surprising. And so that's what the article's about, how UV got so fast. It is, in my opinion, a well-thought-out tool. It has many forward-looking features for not only managing your packages, but building projects that are much more reproducible. That's not something that's covered so much in this case. We've covered that often, and I'll include links to RealPython resources and the library itself so you can learn a little bit more if you aren't familiar with UV. The thing that is most surprising when you use the tool for the first time is its speed when you're installing stuff compared to pip, especially something large, like if you were to install like Jupyter Notebook or something like that into your like virtual environment, the difference between the two is pretty surprising. And so Andrew gets into, well, a common explanation, it's written in Rust, so obviously it's fast, but that's only half the story. And this is part of the story that I had not heard about, and I think it's kind of cool to discuss a bit. The real secret to UV speed is that it's a series of design decisions that, in fact, finally has the modern standards it needed to succeed. So kind of a bit of a chicken and egg problem is how he describes it. You have to understand why pip is slow to kind of compare it. To know what a package needed, you had to run a script called setup.py. But to run that script, you often had to install other tools first. This forced pip into this loop of downloading, running untested code, failing, installing tools, and trying again. And then a bunch of standards kind of changed everything. Between 2016 and 2023, there's a series of PEPs, those Python enhancement proposals we mention often, and they fixed a lot of this. In PEP 5.18 and 6.21, they worked out a lot of the details for pyproject.toml. This allowed listing dependencies in a singular text file that a machine can read without running any code. And then PEP 6.8 was the final piece. In May of 2023, PyPI lets tools see what a package needs without downloading the entire file. So here's a quote from the piece. A tool like UV couldn't have shipped in 2020. The standards weren't there yet. UV launched in early 2024. It didn't just get lucky. It arrived exactly when the infrastructure was finally ready. Speed through elimination. Another reason that UV's fast, it just refuses to do things that slow pip down. It ignores the past. UV doesn't support eggs, which is a binary format that's now kind of somewhat considered obsolete, maybe for over a decade. It skips the fluff. It doesn't compile bytecode. By default, it ignores pip's complex configuration files. It's strict. While pip tries to play nice with malformed packages, UV rejects them. Less tolerance means less code to execute. It's smart about versions. If a package says it requires Python versions less than 4.0, UV ignores that upper bound. This prevents the tool from getting stuck in a loop trying to find the perfect versions that maybe don't really matter. Again, not just Rust optimizations. Andrew gets into some of the best tricks that don't actually require rest that pip could potentially do. Parallel downloads, UV grabs many packages at once, pip does them one by one. Global caching, if you install the same package in 10 projects, UV stores it once and uses hard links. Pip usually copies it 10 times, wasting time and disk space. The pub/grub algorithm, UV uses a sophisticated solver that learns from its mistakes. When it hits a dependency conflict, it remembers why and doesn't make the mistake again. So where does Rust come in? It involves a few features there. Zero copy deserialization. UV uses RKYV to deserialize cached data without copying it. There's links for all this stuff in the article if you want to go a little deeper into all the technology under the hood here. Thread level parallelism. Rust can parallelize across threads, natively sharing memory without serialization boundaries. And then there's no interpreter startup. Every time pip spawns a subprocess, it pays Python startup cost. UV's a single static binary with no runtime to initialize. And then UV packs versions into U64 integers where possible, making comparison and hashing fast. So key takeaway, UV is fast because of what it doesn't do, not because of what language it's written in. Pip could implement many of these features functionality-wise, but it doesn't. In many cases, for backward compatibility, with 15 years of edge cases, pip will always be slower than a tool that starts fresh with modern assumptions. Again, these are his words, Andrew's words. There's a bunch of good links in the piece. If you want to dig a bit deeper into the peps and other historical items Andrew covers in it. So thanks again, Andrew.
Yeah, backwards compatibility is always a bugbear, right? Like if you're just software in general, if you're in the position of being able to say, oh no, we're going to cut it off. At this point, you're done. yeah. It often drastically simplifies your code, but there's plenty of reasons for not doing that, right? If you remember Python 2 to 3, well, if pip suddenly declared that they were no longer going to support all this stuff that
yes.
that people are still using, yeah, there would be effigies burned. So it's,
you can watch the documentary for some details on the vitriol behind that stuff.
So that there's definitely some advantages being able to be latest to market and, draw a box around what you're going to do and what you're not going to do.
Yeah, you can kind of move forward. I see that in a lot of our technology these days. There's potential to build on top of stuff and necessarily not have to bring everything with you.
Yeah.
Cool. What's your first one?
My first article for 2026 is titled Why Python's Deep Copy Can Be Slow and How to Avoid It. It's by Saurabh Mishra. And if you've got an object in Python, there are multiple ways of creating a copy of it. This comes down to how you want the copy to behave when the object contains a reference to other objects. So let's say you've got a list of dictionaries. One way to copy the list would be create a new list that points at the same dictionaries that are in the first list. This is known as a shallow copy, and it tends to be quick. The problem with this, of course, is that if you change one of those dicts in the first list, you see that change in the second list because it's pointing to the same dict. Alternatively, you can use the copy module's deep copy method, which transverses all the references and creates copies of everything. Not only would that list contain copies of the original dicts, but if the dicts themselves pointed at other objects, those would be copied as well. As you might guess from that behavior, this operation can be expensive.
Yeah.
It's even messier than you might first expect because some of those objects might be pointing to each other. So the deep copy method also has to figure out whether there are shared objects within the hierarchy. And like with a lot of operations in Python, there's a dunder method for deep copy, which means custom code can get called as well. Like I said, messy. Saurabh's article includes a short benchmark to highlight the differences. In his example, the deep copy takes 664 times longer than the shallow copy. So much so that it's actually faster to pickle the object into a binary blob than unpickle it into a new thing. Wow. This, of course, is limited by the constraints of pickle, though, so it's not always the answer. For a more real-world example, the article shows a recent edit to the Pydantic AI framework. This is an extension to Pydantic for AI workflows. An agent inside of this has a list of messages, which to avoid mutating to mess things up, would use deep copy on that list when it appends new content. This was expensive, especially for long lists, and so a new optimization was done that was pickier about when to shallow copy versus when to deep copy, and it resulted in a 180 times speed up of the code. If all this isn't fun enough, Pydantic itself, which has model copy, triggers deep copy under the covers, so sometimes you're paying the cost without necessarily even knowing it. In the case of Pydantic, it's significantly faster to actually create a new model with the same arguments than it is to actually call the copy. The article goes on to give some advice. Prefer shallow copies or new objects over deep copies. Copy only what you need. Avoid copying immutables or read-only data. You can use that serialization trick I talked about, but you have to be careful because it limits what can and can't be done this way. And be aware of your libraries. For example, NumPy has a copy method that's very fast because it's kept down at the operation extension level, so it's not using the Python magic to do this stuff. There's some good depth to this article with nice examples and useful advice. I'm looking forward to see more content from Sora.
Yeah, that's cool. Copying is such a common thing that people think would be efficient, especially for them writing the code.
Yep.
But in this case, it may make more sense to, like you said, structurally like build these new versions of objects or kind of different definitions of things.
Yeah, I ran into this myself recently with one of my own libraries, and I was calling into somebody else's library and they were touching things that I didn't want them to touch. So my default answer was, okay, I'll just deep copy everything and pass the deep copy down.
Here's your version.
And it was fine until I started dealing with slightly larger chunks of data. And then all of a sudden the morass set in. And so I kind of had to do exactly what he was recommending. I went back in and figured out, okay, what exactly of this has to be copied? What are they going to touch? What they're not going to touch? And I basically went with as shallow as I could get away with. And it made a significant difference, right? Like it went from like a minute for the program to start up down into like 3 or 4 seconds.
Wow. Yeah.
So it can make a big difference if you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. The trick is always the mutability thing. And
yeah,
it's definitely dives deep into that whole idea. So
yeah.
Great. My next one is from Philip Exeni. He's not only been a previous guest on the show, but he's also a real Python team member. And it's titled, How to Serve a Website Using Fast API. There's my callback. Using HTML in Jinja 2. The goal, as set forward in the article, is to serve dynamic websites from Fast API endpoints using Jinja 2 templates powered by CSS and JavaScript. And it leverages Fast API's HTML response, static files, and Jinja 2 templates classes, which are maybe things that most people don't touch inside of Fast API. I would think a lot of people think of it mainly for, you know, building an API and touching things in and out of a database. So you're kind of using Fast API much more like a traditional Python web framework. It's 3 steps, which I kind of like for a step-by-step project. It's very compact, which I think will get people in and out playing with all of this technology. Your first step, I guess it is a fourth step, sort of secret step, is the pre-step of setting up your virtual environment, installing Fast API. You need to specify the square bracket standard install, which includes a couple things that aren't just part of Fast API. It includes an ASCII gateway, this thing called UVicorn, ASCII standing for Asynchronous Server Gateway Interface. And then it also, under the hoods, includes Jinja 2 for templating. And again, a lot of people might have used it. And Jinja 2 is really kind of its own topic. It's used by, gosh, I don't know if all, but most of the web frameworks that I'm familiar with, Flask and Django and a lot of the other modern tools out there. It helps you build HTML pages out of a set of templates and can have logic inside of them to build out sections and help you kind of create not only pages, but like entire websites out of your data without having to write lots and lots of HTML, which is nice. I'll include some links for the further research if you want to dive into that and learn a little bit more about Jinja. Step one in this particular project is, all right, how do you return basic HTML over an endpoint, an API endpoint? So you're going to take a close look at the Fast API example application. You commonly encounter functions returning dictionaries, which the framework transparently serializes into JSON responses, but Fast API can allow you various custom responses. Besides that, HTML response can return content as text HTML type, which your browser interprets as a web page. So Philip has you build a new file that employs Fast API's response class, HTML response. And then again, like all of our step-by-step the code is included there. You can copy and paste from it, because I know typing out HTML is a bit of a gear shift if you've been coding Python for a while. And then you test the endpoint. So that kind of ends step one. Step two, you level up your Fast API with now using the Jinja 2 templates. So it lets you separate your HTML structure from Python logic while providing features like variable interpolation, which I mentioned before, and template inheritance. So you can have sort of stack these things and call the other templates inside of it. The project is creating this sort of random color generator that is going to demonstrate how Jinja templates work. And so that kind of gets you through that step. And step two, you actually start playing a little bit with Jinja 2. And then step three, you then do the rest of the construction. He calls it serve your website with Fast API. You build a directory to place your templates, and you know, literally called templates. And then you create the base HTML file. And then you build another common directory for a project like this, static, which is going to hold your CSS and JavaScript files, stuff that you won't typically be touching. The CSS, of course, doing the styling. You build some logic that makes things flow a little bit better, and then it lets you copy out the random color that is being generated in this page, because every time you refresh, it shows a whole new color on the page, and then if you're like, oh, I like that color, it'll generate the hex code for you, and you can pull it out of that. So it's a fairly basic project, but the goal is to familiarize yourself with the techniques. He offers a bunch of next steps to extend this application. You could make it a RESTful API, create API endpoints that let users create their own color pool they'd like to use. You could do database integration, adding persistent storage to save your favorite colors, using SQL Alchemy with Fast API. Again, links to those resources. Async requests, handle multiple requests concurrently without blocking, making it more efficient. So a few ideas there for you to go. It ties up with this FAQ section. You'll find that in a bunch of recent RealPython pieces where, you know, you might have a question about how different things work and so forth. And so we have this sort of collapsible FAQ section that you can get into. And of course, an interactive quiz. So thanks, Philip. One note I want to mention, that the very first comment on the piece says, why don't you use an existing framework? You know, in this case, he's saying, why don't you just use Fast HTML? That's not really the point of a step-by-step project. The point was like learning how to use these libraries and how they interact and kind of learning that sort of stuff. And I get it. Like, there are libraries that combine everything together, but sometimes it's good to learn how to use the tools, and hence our step-by-step projects.
Yep, rhymes with Django, but sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Why roll your own when,
No, there are times when you're using something like Fast API where you need a little bit of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you might need the front end stuff.
And switching to something else might be too expensive. You might have an existing project and you have to add it on. There's also nothing like rolling your sleeves up and playing with a project to learn the topic.
Yeah, and I like it too, because this is like, again, with three and a half steps, you can touch it like in an afternoon and get pretty far, which is good, and see something working, and then get, hopefully it stirs ideas for how you can kind of continue playing with it.
Yeah.
So what do you got next?
We seem to have a bit of a performance theme going on this week. My next article is The Uselessness of Fast and Slow in Programming by Jeremy Bowers. The article isn't actually Python specific. It's a bit of an opinion piece. The premise goes like this. No other industry spans the orders of magnitude that software engineering does. You might be trying to optimize a loop to squeeze extra nanoseconds out, or on the extreme other end, trying to accelerate a calculation that's spanning thousands of cores and running for weeks. And sometimes you're doing the one in order to achieve the other. He goes a little tangential to talk about how astronomers sometimes have to think about quantum mechanics, but let's give him the fact that this is more the exception than the rule. And one of the side effects of this massive difference in scale is our brains really aren't good at dealing with it. And then yet there's the internet. So as coders, we frequently get into conversations about fast and slow and pretend we can draw dividing lines between the concepts. And one example he uses is programmers often worry about, you know, how fast is my web framework, making it part of their decision-making process when they're selecting one. However, on modern hardware, 10,000 requests per second is easily achievable by pretty much every library out there. And so does it really matter if one of them is able to do twice that or not? The bottleneck quickly becomes something else. The network, the database, queries, what someone else is doing to you on your shared server. But since there is a number attached to a framework's performance, we as programmers often obsess over it. And it gives us something to compare. It gives us something to argue about, and who doesn't like to argue about it?
Yeah.
So the article continues with a couple more examples. It talks about our tendency towards premature optimization and then wraps up with something I'm just going to read directly. I would suggest that you try to abstain from describing things as fast or slow. Strike the terms from your vocabulary. Be more specific about how the thing is fast or slow, against what metric, and in what order of magnitude of time the thing operates on. So it's a neat little thought piece, and I think it's always useful to sort of see this kind of thing and step back and go, yeah, how am I getting into arguments over things that I don't need to? Or as often happens with this kind of stuff, what you consider fast and what I consider fast, what you worry about is fast and what I worry about are completely different things, right? So
yeah, it's so funny. I feel like that happens with the web lately, where all this great programming is happening as far as like designing the site. And then the person comes along and it's using like full size images that are not compressed in any kind of way. And you're just like waiting for the page to load. And you're like, why didn't anybody think about that part of it? Like, optimizing stuff.
When I was promoing the Django book, I was on a non-Python podcast. You get the questions from the audience as you're having the conversations. And it was like, I think like the first comment was, Python's slow. And I was like, yeah, okay.
Is there a question here?
All right. Yes, it is. It is slower than what you're doing. And I can produce 3 websites in the time it takes you to produce 1. So, yeah.
Right.
What does slow mean to you and what are you concentrating on? So, anyhow, now that I've opened your minds with some abstract thought about performance, I've got an extra little tidbit to go with it, which I think might provide fuel for exactly the kind of argument Jeremy was trying to forestall. So, Michael Kennedy of TalkPython fame, that's 2 shout-outs in 1 podcast. He was busy over the holidays.
Yep.
Michael wrote an article called Python Numbers Every Programmer Should Know, and it's a massive list of performance info about your favorite language. There's all sorts of stuff in here, like how long it takes to append something to a list, importing certain common modules, using f-strings, and so much more. Now, I'm not sure I entirely agree with the title, whether or not every programmer needs to know this.
Right. Based upon what we just talked about.
Exactly. But I suspect Michael's tongue is firmly in his cheek. This is actually the echo of an older article from Jeff Dean and Peter Norvig. We'll link to that if you want to see how performance has changed in the last 15 years. And it was about numbers, like how fast your cache is and that kind of stuff. So I think he's intentionally kind of being a little glib about the title there. I actually think Jeremy might be okay with knowing that a list append in Python takes 29 nanoseconds, as long as you didn't mention whether or not it was fast. So it all ties together. So a couple interesting bits here.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python video course. It covers a topic that we discussed this week and is an exploration of how to simplify working with HTML and web front ends in Python. The course is simply titled Jinja Templating. It's based on a Real Python tutorial by previous guest Philip Exeni, and the video course is presented by my co-host Christopher Trudeau. Christopher shows you how to install the Jinja template engine and create your first Jinja template. You'll render a Jinja template in Flask and use for loops and conditional statements with Jinja. How to nest Jinja templates and modify variables in Jinja with filters and use macros to add functionality to your front end. Templates are an essential ingredient in full stack web development. With Jinja, you can build rich templates that power the front end of your Python web applications. Like most of the video courses on Real Python, it's broken into easily consumable sections, and each lesson includes a transcript, including closed captions. And you'll have access to code samples for the technique shown. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Well, I think that takes us into our discussion, which is yet another sort of conversation that I have been seeing across the internet. I did a show recently with Mark Brooker about spec-driven development. And I guess it's one of those things, you buy a car and you start to see that same car everywhere. And then you're like, oh, a lot of people have this car. Oh, cool. You know, and is that just a relation type of thing to it being new in your brain? But I'm seeing articles now across all the place. And one of them that popped up in various feeds as I was looking through it was one called Spec-Driven Development, The Waterfall Strikes Back. And I thought it was an interesting piece. It's by Francois Zananotto. I'm just going to take this from his conclusion. From his conclusion, agile methodologies killed the specification document long ago. Do we really need to bring it back from the dead? Spec-driven development seems born from the minds of CS graduates who know their project management textbooks by heart and dream of removing developers from the loop. I think it's a missed opportunity to use coding agents to empower a new breed of developers, those who use natural language and build software iteratively. Let me end with an analogy. Coding agents are like the invention of the combustion engine. Spec-driven development keeps them confined to locomotives when we should be building cars, planes, and everything in between. Oh, and just like combustion engines, we should use coding agents sparingly if we care about the environment. So his piece is pretty strongly on this idea, like this is maybe not the best direction for us to head in this AI sort of fueled future of developing stuff, how things should remain agile and we shouldn't go all the way back to waterfall. I'm going to tie it in with another piece. This is by Rob Bowley and it's from his blog, Adventures in Software Development. It's titled, Coding Has Never Been the Bottleneck. It has a meme at the front of it that I think is pretty funny. You guys probably have seen the two astronauts on the moon theme. One says, with AI, coding is no longer the bottleneck. And then the astronaut with the gun behind him says, never was. Both of them touch on really similar themes here, and they actually literally reference the same book and follow-up article, which I think is interesting. There was a book that we've mentioned on the show before in 1975. Fred Brooks published The Mythical Man Month. And what I wasn't familiar with on the, I guess, the 10-year anniversary or so of when it came out, he wrote an essay or paper that went along with it called No Silver Bullet in 1986. And it was added to that anniversary edition of Mythical Man Month. And I think it's interesting that these two people are pulling on this same thread in almost kind of opposite directions in a lot of ways. I'll pull a couple excerpts from No Silver Bullet, Essence and Accidents of Software Engineering. How much of what software engineers now do is devoted to the accidental as opposed to the essential? Unless it is more than 9 out of 10 of all effort, shrinking all the accidental activities to zero time will not give an order of magnitude improvement. Therefore, it appears that the time has come to address the essential parts of the software task, those concerned with fashioning abstract conceptual structures of great complexity. And he suggests four different things. Exploiting the mass market to avoid constructing what can be bought, which I'd have to read a little further into that to understand what he's meaning by that. I don't know if you have a note on that.
The modern version of that would be use open source.
Okay. Yeah, because again, 1986.
Don't reinvent the wheel. If you can buy a library and now it would be don't reinvent the wheel, use an open source library.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Using rapid prototyping as part of a planned iteration in establishing software requirements. I think we've talked about that. That's still around. Growing software organically, adding more and more functions to systems as they are run, used, and tested. Identifying and developing the great conceptual designers of the rising generation. I think a lot of those points are kind of leaning more toward the idea of like, okay, specifications are kind of good.
Part of this is a angels dancing on the heads of pins kind of argument, right? The word agile and waterfall both have a lot of baggage to them.
Right.
And so, like with fast and slow, look at me with my callback. Right. You may end up in an argument over it and not even be talking about the same things.
And just talking past each other instead of pulling on the same string.
Yeah. So, like, waterfall itself wasn't actually invented as waterfall.
Yeah, you mentioned this to me when we started our planning session the other day.
And what I mean by that is, so the term waterfall actually came out of a paper in the 1970s. And the guy who wrote the paper wasn't saying, hey, I've got a new idea for a process. He was looking at the processes that were being used in organizations and putting labels on it.
Okay.
And a lot of those processes grew organically out of like the construction industry. And oftentimes in construction, you do things like you write everything down and you don't you don't dig into the ground until you've done it.
Yeah, they literally start with blueprints.
Yeah. And of course, the irony of this, which no one ever, as soon as they go down that path, no one ever talks about. If you've actually watched a construction site, they are constantly adapting as they go.
Oh, yeah.
So there is more planning there than in, say, what we now would call an agile mechanism, but often they end up having to adapt anyways. And you see it in waterfall projects in the result of what's called a change request, because you get halfway through your waterfall project and you go, oh, this isn't working.
Yeah.
And then somebody goes, oh, well, we have to, that's not what I meant. Well, you signed off on the document. Well, yeah, but it's still not what I meant. And so change happens anyways. So you really, what you start to talk about here is sort of this spectrum of how much change as you go along. I find the, you know, bringing the waterfall to the conversation about spec-driven development, I almost feel like it's missing the point.
Yeah.
Because when we do agile, it's not like we don't write anything down and we don't talk about what we're going to build.
Right.
We still are writing certain things. So the question then becomes how much of the project. The traditional waterfall, nothing starts until the spec is completely fully written. Well, if you're using spec-driven development to build a module, well, then you're still, that's not much different than writing a story in Agile, right? So like some of this starts to become a scope thing.
Yeah.
And I think what all of this comes back to, and this is why they're talking about Brooks and all those pieces, is our industry has a rich history of thinking that our next advancement will mean programmers won't have to exist anymore.
Right.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Embarrassingly, they thought COBOL was going to be written by business people. They thought SQL was going to be written by business people. And in both cases, what happened? Well, programmers had to learn those things.
Yeah.
And I think we're starting to get to that same place. The skill...
You mean with these new tools?
With the new tools, yeah. So the skill of taking a business idea and turning it into a sufficient codex to get a precise result is a skill.
Yeah.
And whether you're doing that in C or Python or in English that you are feeding to an AI, you still have to know how to talk the computer's language in order to get the result you want.
I want to mention this one section here real quick, because this is again from that paper, No Silver Bullet. And I just love the heading of the part two. Does it have to be hard?
And the answer is yes. Like the answer really is yes. I've run into this in teaching. There are folks who seem to be able to pick up the idea of breaking something down into stepwise pieces.
Yeah.
And then like figure out how to do that to construct something. And there are folks who find that very, very hard. And the first set of folks tend to make good programmers and good business analysts and those kinds of people. So whether you're working on the English side or the programming side, it's the idea of taking this big idea, breaking it into the constituent parts so you can figure out how all the parts fit together.
Right. And including the team of people that you're building it for,
yes,
making sure you're building the right thing.
Yes. And those who are not so great at that, they can learn it. It is a learned skill. But if you ignore that, you won't get anything but slop. And whether it's AI-driven slop or programming-driven slop, right? Like,
right.
You see it all the time in large projects, right? We go, oh, we've got an idea. We think this is it. And then you stick it in front of a client and the client's like, oh, that's not what I meant. That's not helping me at all. In fact, there's a joke in the industry, which is IQEC requirements, which is I know it when I see it. So that the customer can't even like... can't even like tell you what they want. And so you're
right, but I'll know it when I see it in front of me.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So, you know, even in the business analyst space, there's this idea of requirements elicitation, and it's the pulling the teeth of trying to understand what the business problem is.
Yeah, totally.
So that you can translate that into a place that you can produce a product. And whether we're translating that into a bunch of markdown files that we're then feeding into ChatGPT or Claude or whatever it is, or whether we've got a programmer writing the code, you still need someone with that skill set who can do that translation. And I think that's, I think what's going to happen with a lot of these AI tools, assuming we can get to the point where we get past the hype,
right,
is there are going to be places where they're useful. They're going to speed some programmers up. Hopefully it'll remove some of the boring boilerplate stuff that we are currently doing.
Right.
But it's still going to be a skill of, I need to figure out what the requirements are to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And right now we call those programmers.
It's just like another abstraction layer,
yes,
if you will. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, at the end, it's like, it still comes down to like solving people's problems and solving the right problems. And
there was a course that I taught years ago, which was like a explaining DevOps to non-programmers, essentially, was so that they get it, you know, it was like a one day, they get enough of the kind of idea. And the exercise we do in the course is you have to write like a little recipe as if you were a robot, and you have to get from one end of the room to the other, turn, and then pick up a ball, and then take the ball to another, like there were a couple spots on the floor. You had to move the ball from one spot to the other. And they would have to write the instructions down, and then I would be the most malicious robot on the planet, right? So if it said, if it said take 5 paces, and at 3 paces I was in the wall, then I would just keep bumping into the wall, right?
Right.
And like, there is a real skill to being able to break it down. And I was always fascinated by the fact that I'd say about half my class would get it immediately. And as soon as they saw me bump into the wall, they'd go, okay, so what would they do? Well, they'd try it themselves, and then they'd test it. And these are all things we think about as programmers, right? I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Oh, I said left, I meant right. Okay, right. And you fix it.
Yeah.
And then the other half of the class just had me bumping into walls for the next, for the rest of the day. Like they just didn't seem to be able to get that. And again, I think it's teachable. I'm not saying people can't learn this stuff, but if you haven't learned that, it doesn't matter what you type in Markdown and spit into AI, right? Garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah. The thing that I liked out of my conversation with Mark that I was not expecting was there's a lot of people writing prompts and making usable stuff out of that, but a lot of it is lost at that point.
Yes.
And the idea of repeatability is a big section of it too. This idea like, okay, well, let's write down what we set forth to do so that we can not only projects get messed up for multiple reasons and they'd be able to restart and reset or reproduce something later. You know, you think of like, you know, data science-y kind of stuff where you're like, okay, I'm going to move this to this other, you know, from my laptop into the actual lab or what have you, and so forth. And I think that's a big part of it that isn't necessarily there. It's not just the specifications. It's also the, you know, reproducibility of this thing. It's not trying to be so pedantic about like, oh, it's got to be, you know, like you said, like kind of doing the step-by-step-by-step. It's part of that, I think, is being missed also and talked past as we go through it.
Well, you end up in a maintenance place, right? So are you maintaining the prompt?
Yeah.
So when somebody says, I want a new feature, you've got two avenues, right? You can either go and add that feature into the prompt and then regenerate everything.
Right.
Or you can then create a new prompt, which is to maintain the existing code and hope that it integrates.
Yeah.
And I suspect there are problems with both of those.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we've got a bunch of recent resources on RealPython where we're doing, you know, demonstrations of some of these tools to kind of get people familiar with them. And one that Martin did recently where he's exploring Cursor, he, you know, it takes two different of these AI agents and just basically pits them against each other. Like, okay, come up with a solution for me. And one's finished already and has like a solution on there and the other one's still generating it. And they might get to a similar type of result. But it's one of these things that he covers a little bit in it. I don't want to go too far into it, this idea of determinism and non-determinism. And that's, I think, one of the things that maybe is new for some people who haven't, you know, explored it. Like if you've been writing Python scripts or you've been doing maybe, again, going back to computer science kind of stuff, you might be doing things where it's very, or I'm sorry, data science kind of stuff. You might be just doing very, very step-by-step deterministic stuff. And now you're including an AI agent and saying what you think you want, and maybe you miss something in your specification as you're saying your prompt out or whatever, and it can be interpreted multiple ways by these different programs. And I think that's maybe another conversation we can get into. But
well, the other aspect too here is I find with a lot of programming assist tools, just generally AI or anything else,
yeah,
they seldom do a good job about thinking about the deployment and management process.
Sure.
So I had a client a few years back. They had gone, it wasn't called no code, but that's what we call it now. It was an older tool, but they were basically using one of these kind of no code tools where you're dragging and dropping stuff into place.
Puzzle piece kind of stuff.
And it worked. It was fine. But the problem was you had to use their tool and the output was essentially binary. It wasn't, but close enough. And so when you had a bug and you had a different version in dev than you had in staging and you had in production,
yeah,
you couldn't patch. Like it wasn't possible. You had to basically take what was in production and roll it back into somewhere in dev and make the change there, because if you had been adding features along the way, there was no way to just roll out the one single piece, right?
Yeah, okay.
And of course, when you've got, and this particular client had like a half dozen of these systems running and had four or five teams, each of them using these tools. And of course, bugs pop up and failures happen. And this is the life of a software developer. But the execs who bought the tools saw the surface level, hey, look how quick this is. I can slap something together and even my VAs can understand it and I don't need a programmer. And 5 years on, they were having to hire very expensive consultants who were specialists in this tool in order to manage all of this. And the money they were trying to save went away, right? Yeah. And I only saw a little bit of it because I was actually working with the teams that they had brought in to replace all these tools from scratch. But I've seen this over and over again that like we go to use these kinds of tools and we don't think about things like, okay, well, what happens if there's a bug? Where, how do we manage that? What does that look like? And I do wonder whether we're going to run into something kind of similar with some of the spec-driven pieces, right? Like, what do I do, right? So am I having an interactive conversation with Claude to just fix that bug, or are we going back to the spec? And so, like, a lot of it depends on how you're going to use it. If you're doing something data science-y, a lot of data science scripts are one-offs. You write them, you never look at them again.
Right.
Bring up Michael Kennedy again for some reason. He must be on my mind. But I was chatting with him on the podcast a few weeks back, and he was talking about some of the things that he had done successfully with AI. And a lot of the examples he gave were things like, well, I needed to translate a Bootstrap 3 site into Bootstrap 4. Well, great. Well, you're never going to look at that code again. So
right. We're now on 4. Hooray.
Yeah. So if it's a one-way thing, great, because then you didn't have to write all that code and it's fantastic. But as soon as you start maintaining these things, the questions change. And I'm not sure we've thought about that too much yet. And just to loop this back to your comments there about the determinism versus the non-determinism, well, if a system isn't deterministic, well, that means you may not get the same result the next time you run the problem.
Right, right.
What does that mean for maintenance, right? So,
yeah, I mean, the model's changing under your feet constantly. That's like literally the story of 2025 is like, well, how many models came out?
Yeah. Well, and even without that, AI isn't necessarily deterministic even without the model changing, generally, right? Yeah, like it's just not how it's built.
Different runs, yeah.
That this is the nature of machine learning type stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll table it for now. The other funny thing that Rob Bally had in this thing is, you know, he has coding has never been the bottleneck. He references another piece of artwork that somebody had created with a bunch of monkeys on keyboards saying, typing is not the bottleneck. And so, yeah, it's just funny to think about, like, this is a perpetual thing, even with our new stuff.
Well, even independent of the technology, right? Like I have this conversation with managers all the time. It's like, why aren't my programmers at their desk? I'm like, they might be doing their best work while they're walking around the block. Like the hard part isn't the typing, right? The hard part is thinking about the problem. So,
All right. Well, that takes us into projects. boy, is mine timely. I don't want to get into it much, but the project is titled X-Ray. It's a Python library for finding bad redactions in PDF documents. It's by the Free Law Project, which I think is really cool that they are actually providing these tools. It kind of brings up the moment when many people learn that, well, that ain't how it works with PDFs. I worked at a law firm for a bit and we needed to redact some documents, and you quickly learn what doesn't work. You can't just draw black boxes over the text. The text in PDF is still selectable and can be copied and pasted into a plain text into another document. Just like its own separate layer, there isn't a Photoshop thing of like flatten my PDF. So unless you were to print it or do some other kind of weird thing. Anyway, after witnessing this problem for years, this is from their piece, we decided it would be good to figure out how common it is. So with some help, we built this simple tool, and you give the tool the path to a PDF. It tells you if it has worthless redactions in it. The tool can be installed via pip or UV or UVX or pipx. There's a tool where you want to install it for the system and maybe use it across the system multiple times as a command line interface tool. Under the covers, X-Ray uses a high-performant tool called PyMU PDF, P-Y-M-U PDF project, and that does the parsing of the PDFs, and it finds rectangles inside PDFs. It finds letters in the same location, renders the rectangle as an image, and inspects the rectangle to see if it's all one color. If it is, then that's a bad redaction. It's a command line thing. You type X-ray and then the path to the file, it returns JSON of what it sees. And even includes like the coordinates of the black box, you know, like where the different corners are. And then in another, you know, portion of the JSON little dictionary there, it has text as the string. So I think it's a kind of a nice little tool. I just want to give it a shout out, and it is fairly timely. So what's next? They are looking for, there are other types of bad redactions, maybe highlighting and other things there. They'd love to have other input or help with that, or documents that might work there. So if you're interested in solving problems like this, you can reach out on their GitHub. Again, it's Free Law Project.
So I've actually got some really strong opinions on this, and it's really important that and you really shouldn't forget, because it's you know, it's important that we think about these things ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, it's good things that I have my own tools for redacting stuff. So we don't get any other extra comments here. Not to get political, right? All right, what's your project?
My project this week is called HTTP Tap, and it's by Sergey Orzansky. What it does is gives you the breakdown of the different phases for a particular HTTP call. For example, you might call HTTP Tap and give it the URL of RealPython's homepage. The tool then connects to the page and gives you a bunch of info about the page, including the IP address, what version of HTTP got used, what version of TLS got used, when the certificate associated with the page expires, how big the page was, where it got served from, all sorts of useful little bits. And then below that information, it prints an ASCII performance graph showing how long each phase of the connection took. When I ran it on RealPython, 90% of the time was spent on the DNS lookup, and which would be an issue with my machine. And then there was a bit of negotiation for the TLS. Then there was the wait phase, which would be the server doing something. And finally, the transfer. So HTTP TAP supports all the usual HTTP methods. So you can muck around with your REST servers. It's IP version 6 aware, and is capable of exporting all that stuff I just talked about as a JSON dictionary if you prefer your data in a more machine consumable format. If you're finding your server is slow and you want to figure out what's causing it, this can be useful. If you're getting a lot of redirects, this also breaks that down for you as well. You can also invoke the library from code, which gives you the ability to use a custom DNS resolver or TLS inspector as well. It's a neat little debugging tool that might just help you out, so I thought it would be good to share it.
Yeah, it's one of the ones that was mentioned in the Trio Labs. I always I think we both mispronounce it Tyro often because it's like a weird spelling of something. But yeah, Triolabs, that top 10 that we mentioned at the top, it was like number 5 in the Python tools. So
dyslexics of the world untie.
Yeah, exactly. All right. With that, thanks again for bringing all these articles and topics this week, Chris.
Always happy to be here.
All right. Talk to you soon. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.